Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
How are we doing, Scott? You okay?
Right.
I can hear you. Hi.
Cheers. Right. Thanks for taking the time out. I know you're a busy guy.
No problem, my
friend.
You're
getting ready to go to Ireland, am I right?
Yes, I am. Saturday morning fly out for Bama. So it should be fun.
Yeah, it's looks like it's a bit of a stacked card in the Irish Bama.
Irish talent as well, you know, is on there. So yeah, looking forward to it. So it should be exciting and loud.
Yeah. So if people, sorry, I didn't introduce you. If people don't know, I've got Daniel Mulvaney-Heady. Is that right?
Close second time, Mulvaney-Heady. That's fine.
It's all right. I just tried to YouTube it to see how you pronounce it, and then a few people said it different.
Now it's Mulvaney-Heady. Exactly how it's spelled, you say exactly that way.
Yeah. So you're a professional MMA, kickboxing, and K1 referee.
Correct. Yes.
And you've been a pro fighter yourself, and you're also a personal trainer as well.
Yeah,
as a coach.
used to be a personal trainer. Then family life took over, and I've delved into you put professional MMA fighter. I'll put that loosely in the sense of that under professional MMA rules, as opposed to, you're right, we used to get paid for it, but not the money that some of the guys are making today at the top level. It's more for me, I explain it to people, the guy, you know, used to be a professional fighter. It's more of like a hobby, because the time I got into it, when I was 16, so that's nearly half of my life ago, was, you know, there wasn't such thing as amateur fights or warm-up fights, so to speak, to be able to then work your progress your way into professional fighting. So, you know, I got chucked into the deep end straight away. But for me, it was more of a hobby or a test, so to speak, to test out the skills, etc., and just to have fun, really. It was something at the time, it was something new, something exciting, something different, and it wasn't as big as it is today. It's led me to the path that I'm on today, being an official in combat sports, which I'm thankful for.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Obviously, you got into MMA when in this country it was not so much unheard of, but it was just taking its sort of first steps into being recognised as a sport than what it used to be called, a thuggish.
Yeah,
basically,
or cage fighter. You still hear it now.
Yeah.
Now and again, hey, I'm a cage fighter or cage fighting. But, you know, that stigma or that kind of word around the sport of MMA now, you know, it is starting to die down, you know, and there's not many events that use the word cage, apart from obviously Cage Warriors. You know, they've had that brand for God knows how long, you know, but you don't hear, you know, whatever MMA show, and then you don't see it anymore saying live cage fighting. You put live MMA show or live combat sports. So it is good. But obviously back then, as you can imagine, there wasn't much social media or stuff for people to understand or to look up what MMA is, you know. So by the time you sat there and explained, hey, MMA, mixture of wrestling with kickboxing, with Thai boxing, with jiu-jitsu, put together, that's what MMA is. By the time you've said that, the guy's like, what the hell? So as soon as you said cage fighting, they're like, oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Oh, you know, well, back then, the names that you used to drop, as opposed to today, is like, oh, the most common one that goes around is Conor McGregor. But back then, it used to be stuff like Chuck Liddell, Tito Ortiz. You know, they're the guys who used to put their names to the sport. You know?
Yeah, see, I've watched it from Ultimate Fighter Season 1, you see. So I'm like the Chuck Liddells, the Tito Ortiz, the Randy Couture's, stuff like that. So obviously, I've watched it 15, 16 years. So when people said, oh, it's cage fighting, I'm like, no, like they're athletes. Like, but the evolution, like you said, the evolution of it coming from a cage fighter, which gave it such a bad name as a brand, basically. And it's evolved into MMA, and they're putting the stamp on MMA. So they know that people are athletes. They're not fighters. I watched a countdown. I watched it this morning, and then they showed a clip of something else, and it said, I think it might have been, who was it? Some fighter said that he's he wasn't the best fighter. It was Brendan Schaub. I watched a clip of his podcast.
Yeah.
And he said he's not the best fighter. He wasn't the most technically gifted fighter. But when he was in his prime, he was the best athlete in the division. He was, he wanted to be the best athlete. That's what he was. He was an athlete and he wanted to test himself in fighting. And when he first moved to LA, that's what he was. He was just an athlete.
Yeah.
So to go into mixed martial arts, it kind of fitted for him. So to go now where they're all being recognized as athletes, obviously you've got some that are just freaks of nature, athlete-wise, and can back it up 90% of the time with the fighting side of it. And then you've got other ones that are just pure and utter athletes that can take an absolute beating that can last three rounds and people watch them because they can last, but they're not technically gifted fight-wise.
No, and that's the, I guess the beauty of the sport today is that, you know, even looking at it from an official point of view, that working grassroots level shows or with grassroots level fighters to the top of the food chain, so to speak, especially in Europe, at least, you get to see the guys who are fighters and have got that grind in them and they are there, you know, to fight and they want to make money, that who turn into athletes and realizing, hey, I can make a living off this. I can, you know, pursue a career to make it to whether it be UFC, Bellator, Bama, Cage Warriors, they're the ones that pop to mind, or fighting on shows like that. So, and you know, the attitude, whether it be from the lifestyle, the diet, the way they train, and you put that together with a fighter and an athlete, combine them two together, trust me, you'll have a great athlete and a great fighter. Where, you know, and people don't realize the grind and the effort these grassroots level guys put in. People look at like someone like Ali that comes to mind, good friend of mine, Brad Pickett. They go, oh yeah, he made it to UFC, etc. But what they didn't see is those days when he used to fight on Portsmouth Harbour on a UK one show, or used to fight at a leisure centre, literally for pettings, sometimes for free, to grind his way. And then he had a goal, and he obviously realised, and it was at a time where UFC was peaking as well, coming into Europe. And he managed to make his career out of that. And, you know, today he runs a very successful gym and pool of fighters who are making a name for themselves. But that's the great thing about this sport. And it has grown. And, you know, lucky enough that we're in an era that these youngsters, especially guys who still go to college, university, don't have to worry about a mortgage or paying bills, etc. You know, some of them are lucky enough that they have their mum and dad to pay for their training.
Yeah.
You know, and all they've got to concentrate on is getting their studies done. And you know, trying to fight and, you know, to make it professional. So it's good to see that level, but it's also, people do need to remember that there are still grassroots level fighters out there who are grinding and trying to make a name for themselves. And some of them may do, some of them may not. You know, you've got to make that decision whether it's for you or it isn't. You know,
it's like I covered the 8-man tournament for Cage Warriors Academy.
Yes, yes.
And I spoke to six of the guys, and one of them, Ashley Kilmans, and he said, I think it was Ashley, he said one of the guys at his gym, he just fights just as a hobby. He trains three times a week. He's still in the amateur ranks and he still fights, but he enjoys it that much. He's not wanting to go into the pros or anything like that. And he's been doing it he'd been doing it for 5 years. But he just does it at weekends just for something to do because he really enjoys the sport and he wanted to get involved in it. But, and because he had that like athletic side, he thought, I'd give it a try. It doesn't interfere with his normal job. He still trains 3-4 times a week and then genuinely just does it as a hobby. And he's more than happy to do it at the amateur level.
Exactly. And the thing is, what I'd say on that note with the amateur guys, you know, some of them, you know, win or lose, they're so hard. Some of them are hard on themselves regarding, you know, their records, etc. That's the place to be able to make your mistakes, to work your holes, to work your game. And when the time's right, it will happen for you to make that step. That's the difference now. Whereas when the time's right, you turn professional. And by that, I mean, doesn't mean, hey, I'm going to turn professional and fight under professional rules. When I mean you turn professional is when you make that pro debut and you get paid and you've got a good pathway to go and make it full. Whereas before, there never used to be anything like amateurs or make mistakes. It used to be pro rule sets and that is it. So if you come away with 3 or 4 losses, 9 times out of 10, no big shows would look at you. Whereas now, even on amateurs, you know, you could have your losses, you could have your wins. It doesn't matter, because then the minute you turn pro, all that, 9 times out of 10, is forgotten about. Anyway, what matters is what the statement you make when you do turn pro, or you find the pro rules. And some people do like just flying over the weekend. And the realistic thing is that still, even to this day in 2018, unless you're top game, the money isn't great. You know, you first and foremost, you've got to do the sport for the love of it, you know, and for you to be able to put them hours in grinding, like you said, someone still having a full-time job and trying to train twice, sometimes 3 times a day, and fight at the weekends, and maybe have, you know, keep hold down please a wife and the kids, yeah. You know. So first of all, you have to love it. But it's good that someone like Cage Warriors Academy, like on BCMMA, like Jack Mason's show, it offers that 8-man tournament, or gives a platform for amateur fighters to be able to showcase their skills. And hopefully more shows like that will pop up, you know.
Yeah, see, like I spoke to Jack the other day.
Yeah.
And I was asking him about it.
Which was a good interview, by the way. I did listen to it.
Thank you very much. I was proper geeking out, but I had to try and rein it in, obviously, because he's such a legend in the UK sport and Europe and in the whole MMA game. I was just like, right, calm yourself down, like, sort of thing. But yeah, he's such a nice guy, and what he's doing for grassroots MMA as a whole, not just for the UK, but for Europe, and not just for his academy, for all these other academies and stuff, and for the gyms and stuff. Like, I was asking him about the academy, because I went to the last show in Colchester, where they had the 8-man tournament, and I was saying, oh, is there going to be another one, like another tournament? Obviously, they've got the massive Grand Prix coming up that they've announced. They're trying to keep details as much as they possibly can close to them, but Jack let a few slip. Obviously, he said through these different academies, they're going to have the champion of there, and so on and so forth. But obviously, he was saying that it's really expensive, and obviously, they paid £1,500 to the winner.
Yeah.
I mean, for the rest of the guys in the tournament, my first fight, I watched the first fight, and it was an 18-second knockout walk-off. Yeah. Like, obviously, that guy that got knocked out, he's still got to pay for training. He's still got to pay to get there. He's still got to pay for the hotel, stuff like that. And even the other guys that didn't, like, obviously get knocked out or finished, that didn't get to the final or win it, they've kind of gone there. Obviously, they'll get money from sponsors and ticket sales and stuff. But most of the time, they barely break even to go to the event unless they win it.
Yeah, and there's still something, that's what I was saying about the love of the sport, there's still something there. Some of them guys would have been back in that gym on Monday going, fuck it, I'll do it again. The amount of times, you know, like I say, again, going back to someone like Brad and whatnot, people forget that he didn't just make it to the UFC willy-nilly. He, you know, he used to sell himself, bring tickets down to the gym, try to sell tickets, graft, you know, you got to earn your place in so to speak. You know, you got to have something about you, and especially, you know, if you're selling a lot of tickets these days, promoters will snap you up straight away. You know, one that you know comes to mind is Aaron Chalmers, who's fought on Bama and now is fighting on Bellator. Okay, people slag him off about not being the greatest fighter, etc. He comes from a reality show, but you know, let me tell you, I'm sure that guy still puts his training in, still puts two times to 3 times a day training in there. And he's lucky enough that he doesn't have to go to do a normal day job. Yes, he's got paid from his good sponsors. So he's able to pursue that dream. And the man sells tickets, loads of tickets. I mean, I think it was Newcastle when we went up there for Bama. He alone sold about 2,000 tickets.
Yeah,
now, you tell me what promoter doesn't want that? Someone who can fight, who's never already, he hasn't had any amateur background, but, you know, who's happy enough because the training he'd done, the team that he trains with, the guys he sparred with, and he wanted to just test himself, get in there and do it. And luckily enough for him, if he'd lost, he can walk away and still be on a reality TV show and still have an income coming in. It didn't matter to him, you know, but lucky enough, he's managed to make a name for himself, and he's, you know, stepping into the bigger shows. So, I think, you know, like I said, with the sports, and I get to see it whilst officiating, like I said, the grassroots levels up to the pro guys who do get paid well. It's good to still see that hunger in these fighters, you know.
Well, on the subject of Aaron Chalmers, I'll announce a little exclusive. I'm in talks with his management team to actually get him on a podcast.
Lovely.
Before Bellator.
Yeah.
But yeah, I spoke to Kent Kalpinen. Okay. Obviously, he's on the prelims as well.
Yes.
And I've spoken to Tom Mearns, and they've both discussed this whole situation with Aaron Chalmers. See, for me, it's, you can see two sides of it. Like you said, he brings in fans and stuff like that, and that's what promotions want. Yep. Then obviously you can see the other side from the fighter's side.
Of course.
People like Tom Mearns and Ken Kalpinen, who have gone out there and, not in a disrespectful way to Aaron, but have earned their place on a card that size and are only getting a prelim shot.
Yeah.
But obviously they see the pound signs, the fans he'll bring, the reception he'll bring, the atmosphere,
but that's
everything
where
like that. So they've said, here you go, you can have a main card slot.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, he spent 3 minutes, I've actually got it written down, it's about 3 minutes and 29 seconds in three fights in the cage.
Yeah.
I mean, you know he's going to come and be exciting.
And the thing is, that's the way the business is going. You know, that's how the sport has grown. I mean, look at UFC, for example. They got their CM Punk coming up next, their fight there. I think I read yesterday that 50 Cent rumors going that he signed something with Bellator, whether it's a publicity stunt, someone put out there, he might be fighting Rampage Jackson. Whether it happens, I don't know. But again, look, people need to realize that a business is a business, a promotion is a promotion, you know. And I'm from a promoter's kind of hat on, you know. At the end of the day, you want people to recognize the show, you want people to turn on the TVs to watch the show. Now, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but as a fighter, if I was fighting on that show, if it's going to turn heads to get my profile and for people to watch me fight, regardless of I'm on prelims, main card, just the fact that some of his fans or some people who never known what MMA was, but because of that one guy, they're going to tune in and keep the ratings higher. Hey, you know, good luck. I'll take that.
Yes.
You know? But of course, if you're grinding as a fighter, and like you said, you're grinding, you've been put on that prelim card and you've proved yourself why you should be on the main card, It becomes a little bit of an issue. It's a bugbear, you know. It does, you know. I can see why it pisses them off, but you know, you got to look at it as a promoter side of you. And for me, the whole someone's on a prelim card and not on the main card. For me, I always look at fight events as a whole card.
Yeah.
You know, for me, prelim and main card is only for TV. You know, if I'm on a fight card, I'm on a fight card. Whether it'll be on a UFC, Bellator, Cage Warriors, Bama, just be lucky that you're on a good card, you're on a good promotion, you're getting looked after. I think, which is good, you know, because them opportunities weren't there 6-7 years ago. I'll tell you that now.
Yeah, it's like that was one of the first few questions that I asked Kent and Tom, obviously both on the prelims. Yeah. I said to them, how excited are you to be on such a massive card? Obviously, they know that they're already fighting on the prelims, but they both still turned around and said, oh, well, it's massive. And Kent made a very good point, obviously, like you said, fans coming to watch. He said he doesn't care if Aaron Chalmers brings in 100,000 people to watch the event. If they're only going there to watch him, out of that 100,000 people, whether they're paying for it pay-per-view or he sells 5,000 tickets, they're going to be there the whole day. That's an extra 10,000-15,000 people watching him fight.
Exactly.
So it's still, even if
it's
200 see it, he's still gaining 200 more followers than what he started with. It's more publicity for everyone, in a sense, obviously, because the card's absolutely stacked from Roy Nelson in the main event,
Gegard
Mousasi, Michael Venom Page, Aaron Chalmers, all the way down. Even the prelims have had former world champions on it. So it's not as if, oh, you're on the prelims, that must mean you're shit, you're not good enough for the main card. Because it's not like that. Like you said, it's a card as a whole. Like, you're on the whole event, not just one part of it. People aren't going to be like, all right, that fight's over, I'm going to turn it off.
And, you know, it may open doors to other opportunities, you know, to go and fight on the other European, when Bellator go to, we're talking about Bellator specifically because we're talking about the Bellator 200 that's coming up. Is that opportunities might happen, when they go to Italy, for example. Then they go, hey, you know what, that kid who fought in the prelims, he was pretty good, whether it be win or lose. Hey, he was good. We can call him up for the Italy card, or, you know, even better, for the USA card. You never know. It may, you know, you just got to take chances. And what I say to fighters, don't worry about what everyone else is doing. You know, just concentrate on your stuff and what you need to do. And same goes for officiating. I have officials coming up to me going, hey, man, how can I get into refereeing or judging or commissioning, whatever it may be, to do with the official side of it. You know, I've had people come and go who are, you know, they think they do a couple of events, then, hey, I want to be on the big show. I want to do this. I want to do that. You know, they don't see where you start off from. And, you know, just put the hard work in, put the grind in, and it will happen. And bottom line is, enjoy what you do. If you're doing it for the money, then you're in the wrong game. I'm telling you that right now. Especially
the wrong reasons.
The officiating side, because there is a lot of hard work that needs to put in. There's only a handful of guys I can say that are hand on heart, full-time officials, like where they travel the world week in, week out, and get paid for it, and that's the sole job. I.e., like Big John McCarthy, Herb Dean, Goddard. They're the guys who've put the hard work in 15 plus years. Like obviously, we're talking about John McCarthy. You're looking at 25 years.
Yeah.
Of traveling, of doing things, setting their base, setting their mark in the sport, and now they are reaping the rewards. You know.
Yeah, he's taking a more chilled out approach and commentary.
Yeah, but he's still active on the scene of running his MMA courses, doing the things that he does, him and Herb over in the States. So, and the same with Goddard, who does his stuff with the IMAF over in Europe, etc. And, you know, it's hard work, but sometimes it's sad when you see people, even when I put shit on like Instagram, hey, I'm going to Dublin this weekend, or I'm going to Bulgaria or Sweden, whatever it may be. People think, hey, you know, one, it must be getting paid shitloads, and two, this is such a cushy job. It, for me, it's, I love it. You know, if I could, I would love to. Of course, anyone would like to do what they love for a full-time job and get paid very well for it. But, you know, you can't always rely on the shows, the stability of a show, whether it's cancelling or doing this, etc. You know, you lose money on it. But people don't see the hard work you put into it. People, you know, or they don't see when you travel, literally, you're on a plane, in a hotel, at the venue, back at the hotel, on a plane, home. Sometimes I like that because I get home, come home to my family. But whether it be a fighter or official, you just got to put that grind in, got to put that work in, and everything will come at the right time. You know, there's no jumping the gun or trying to cut corners, etc. It will come at the right time.
Yeah, it's like you're saying, people need to do it for the right reasons. And if they just do it for the money, then it's going to hit them like a truck. Like, basically the reason I started this podcast, the only reason was because I love the sport.
Yeah.
I trained in it. I can't anymore due to injury.
Yeah.
And I'm quite opinionated on it. And I'm quite honest, which is, some people like it, some people don't. But
yeah,
at the end of the day, it's my opinion. If people don't like it, they're not going to listen. If they do, then they are.
Exactly. Well, I guess that's why one of the reasons why most people start podcasts, so they could just get their voices out there. Same, you know, way I see it, as long as you're not hurting anyone, as long as you're not bullying anyone, as long as you're not picking on anyone, your opinion is totally valid. You know,
yeah.
And as you could say something to me now and I could go, you know what? Good luck to you. That's what you think. And this is what I think. Hey, that's it. There's no, you know, but same thing. If you're starting a podcast, a lot of people, you know, go, here we go, another podcast coming up. And if you don't give it a go, if you don't give it a try, whether you have hundreds of followers or 1,000 followers or 1,000,000 followers, it doesn't matter. You could still be enjoying your show, talking to people. In, you know, like you said, Jack Mason you had on the show, Kent you had on the show, Tom you had on the show, talking to those kind of people and still enjoying it. Hey, who gives a damn if it's 5 followers or 5,000
like
followers?
A few people have said to me, "Oh, like, what's your average listen to on your podcast and stuff like that?" And I'm like, that doesn't matter to me. Yeah. Like, I'm still like a kid at Christmas geeking out, talking to people that are watching the sport and that I enjoy watching. Like, for me, this is like, in a sense, meeting, like talking to my idols. Like, how many people would just be able to say, like, look, just give me a ring? Like, I spoke to Brad Scott.
Yeah.
And,
great guy.
He was like, and I met him at the Cage Warriors Academy event. And he was like, he's like, just give me your phone number. He says, yeah, every time you want to chat or this, that, and the other, just give me a call or this, that, and the other. And it's like, people are saying, like, why are you doing it? I'm like, because I'm talking to people that are doing a sport, that actually involved in a sport that I love.
Like,
how many people could just ring Ronaldo or something like that and just say, look, can I just sit and have a chat with you, or can I plan to have a chat with you?
I'll be interested.
You just wouldn't
Brad,
get it. You
I'll
wouldn't
be interested
get it with...
to know if Brad could play football like Ronaldo. You could put that question to him if you talk to him again. But, you know, it goes back to same with the fighters. the opportunities may come, like your podcast. A year down the line, a sponsorship might come along and go, hey, buddy, can you plug our whatever, our product, and we'll bung you £500 or £10 or £5. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, things will start to come in. That's why I say to the fighters, you know, and again, bringing it back to the officiating side of it, especially the amateurs, you know, where you, you know, at the end of the day, my job is to protect the fighters inside the ring or cage, wherever that may be. And when you stop the fights, whether it will be because you're taking unnecessary punishment, etc., you see them. So I get it. You're at that moment in time, you're very upset, you're disappointed, whether it be because you didn't want to tap or you thought that you was doing better, you could have done better. I always say to them, especially the amateur guys, hey, man, listen, be grateful you're walking out of it uninjured, back on the mats on Monday, and still work to that goal. Or some of them, sometimes you do need to tell them, look, well, I won't, but I'd like to think that their coaches or their close friends and partners, sometimes this sport isn't for the people that they think, you know, what they think it is, you know, because everyone sees the glam, the glamour, i.e. like the UFC again and Bellator. Hey, I want to do that. And sometimes you haven't got that in you. Me being one of them, like, you know, you brought back to being a professional fighter. Man, before I got my first win, I had 8 losses on the trot, yeah? And some of those losses, some of the guys were ADCC champions. Some of them guys have gone on to become great coaches and whatnot. And after a couple of wins myself, I had to go, look, do I really want to do this? Am I cut out for this? And you have to really look yourself in the mirror and go, no, not really. But I can use what I've learned and what I know to put it into something else. And if whether you want to stay in the sport, whether it be from officiating, coaching, a cutsman, commissioning, promoting, whatever it may be, you sometimes do need to have a hard look of going, look, fighting ain't in me, or being an athlete isn't in me to get to that level, you know. Otherwise, you end up getting some serious injuries and you could, you know, end up in serious trouble.
Yeah, like you said about some fighters not being happy with you, or their coaches and stopping it and stuff like that, or if you stop it. When I spoke to Jack, obviously he said, like, when I asked him about his cut, obviously it's now viral.
Yes.
I asked him, was it your corner's reaction or was it Mark's reaction or anything like that? And he was like, no, it was genuinely Mark that said to me, look, you're open.
Trust me, yeah.
So obviously from your side of it, whether people like it or not, your main job is fighter safety.
Of course.
Because obviously it is, as blunt as it is, it's a barbaric sport. It's you go out, you come out, or the other guy does. It's no sort of in between. You're going in there to kick the shit out of someone. You're not going in there to have a fight and a cuddle.
The thing is, at the end of the day, look, going to the Jack Mason and with Goddard calling that, as a referee, we have a job to keep fighters safe, right? And not, you know, if you let Jack fight, he would have carried on fighting no matter what. His eyeball could have been hanging out. Knowing that guy, he would have carried on fighting to the end, right? But like I said, as a referee, we're there to protect you. Whether it's, you know, we don't have to wait for someone to get knocked out or wait for someone to get choked out. If we, it's not always, and it's, you know, people are quick to jump on us when they're sitting at home or sitting in a venue where they've got a luxury of a replay or you know, having the commentators commentating, etc. Everyone's in that moment. But as a referee, we are the guys who can see things that not everyone can at that specific time. We can see how the eyes are rolling, like how big a cut is, how deep a submission is, if someone's being put to sleep, etc. So we always get sticked, but what is nice about it sometimes, the praise that a referee gets from a fighter afterwards, going, hey man, thanks for stopping that. Now I realise why you did stop that. Or, you know, like Jack, you know, I mean, that cut was bloody bad. Imagine if he took another couple of shots on top of that, two things could have happened. He either could have got knocked out, or the injury that he's got at the moment could have been worse, which may have delayed his comeback or recovery time to get back into training even longer.
Or even stopped it completely.
Exactly. You know, and like I said, as a referee, our job is, you know, to protect you or protect the fighters, but not always to wait till you get knocked out or subbed out or choked out. You know, sometimes, like I said, we see things and we know when the time is right to stop. to stop the fight. Not everyone will agree, but hey ho, it's a damn if you do, damn if you don't situation. Yeah,
so I've got a perfect example for this one. Did you see the Ricky Simon fight or Simon fight? Where he was choking the guy out.
Yes.
And, yeah. See, everyone was like, oh, he wasn't out. And obviously, there is three sides to the actual whole fight. Obviously, you've got both fighters' sides and then the referee's side.
Yeah.
And it was the referee that called it after the bell had gone. And like I said, obviously, you get not so much you don't get stick whilst you're in the cage or anything like that. But once they've come through or if they've been knocked out and stuff like that and they've realised, then they say, oh, yeah, or this, that, and the other. This guy is still saying, the one that got choked out was still saying that he wasn't out. But Ricky Simon has come out and said his body was completely limp. And even when he got off of him, he actually looked like he was asleep.
Yeah.
And the ref sort of brought him back.
And the thing is, look, we've got to go to the guy because I keep someone safe. And with that, when I first watched that fight, I couldn't see the ref in shot after the fight days. So when the doctors ran in, etc. And he's the one who called that fight. And not many people picked up on that, you know. And once the referee calls the fight, you know, the fight's over, whether it be, look, if you're out during the fight, whether it be before or after the bell, you're out, man. The referee, he can't let you continue, you know. Or, yeah, somebody going, oh, but it was the end of the third round, he made. So what, man? You were put out, you know. And if the referee sees that, not many people see the fighter's eyes, see how their body is reacting, etc. It's a hard job, honestly. People don't understand. Because, like I said, people must go, oh, Dan, I want to be a ref. How do I get into it? I'm like, as nicely as possible, you know, you guess, okay, if that's what you want to do, you know, come if you want to shadow a couple of events. And, you know, they don't realise the work that goes in. And they think it is easy as just standing there, either stopping a fight when someone gets knocked out or tapped out. You know, it is hard. And, you know, like I said, that referee there, he got a bit of backlash, but they don't see this other fights he done where he made good calls or he made good stoppages on other shows or maybe UFC. They don't remember those ones. They only remember the bad ones you made.
Yeah. Well, the guy did good. I'm going to try and pronounce his name now. Dvalishvili. Yeah, I think that's right. Dvalishvili. Obviously, he was rotating his legs to keep his oxygen going round and stuff. And the ref acknowledged that to keep it going whilst he was there. But people don't realise when a fighter's getting choked out, it literally takes a split second and they could be out and come back to straight away. But the body functions don't come back. It's just muscle memory.
Of course.
Obviously, you've seen fighters that get choked out or knocked out and then they start attacking the ref.
Yes. Well, prime example, you know, you another situation is a difficult situation, like with referees, someone getting punched, right? And as they're going down, they so your reaction is to you going in to step in to stop that fight. He's gone down and he pops straight back up for a double leg takedown and he continues the fight and as if nothing's happened, you know. So they're the reactions that you know, the calls that you got to make. Shit, do I step in or stop? Whereas if someone's getting choked out, they go limp and you haven't called that fight, you know, and they come to again. That's when it becomes a problem. As a referee, they're the things we need to realize, we need to see, you know. And I always say it, no one can really comment on what a referee should and shouldn't do unless you're in there. We've got the perfect view, the perfect scenarios and angles to see the things that we need to see. And that's why someone asked me the other day, do you think it's important for referees to train or at least who fought before, etc.? Not necessarily fight, but I do think they have to train, especially the groundwork side of stuff, i.e. when the chokes are going on, whether it be a dast choke, a guillotine choke, anaconda choke, just so you know where to position yourself on what side of the body. Looking for the head, looking for the eye, seeing if the guy has gone limp, see if he's got a hand in there protecting that choke, if he's okay, if he isn't. That, obviously, if you've got a referee standing 10 miles away from the fire and standing on the wrong side of the body and the guy's gone limp and he's not tapping, but yet, you know, he's out cold, then you've got a problem with that referee. But 9 times out of 10, I do say to any of you guys, look, go and train, whether it be BJJ, a bit of wrestling, a bit of submission wrestling, a bit of stand-up as well. Even this morning, I was training that down with the guys. you saying about, you know, 1 minute you're okay, next minute you're not. I got caught in a triangle, thinking I could get out of it, held on, and literally back to the book, I had to tap straight away, you know. But you, fighters do have that, the split second of you talking about, 1 minute they think they're okay, next minute, look, someone's holding up your legs trying to wake you up, you know.
Yes,
and with a choke, with a choke, it's different to a armbar submission or a lock, so to speak. With chokes, as soon as you release that choke, sometimes fighters come back straight away. Not a problem.
Yeah, like you said, you know? Obviously, being caught in like a triangle or something. I've had it before when I was training, and someone had me in a triangle.
Yeah.
And I could feel my eyes shutting. But as soon as my eyelids closed together, split second, they were back open, and I was back to where I originally was.
There we go.
And it's a scary place to be. And obviously, like you said, some fighters have got it, some haven't.
Yeah.
I mean, going back to, obviously, like a big organization, like the Kevin Lee fight,
yeah,
some fights could have jumped in when that head kick landed from Barboza, because he was all over the place.
Exactly.
If that ref would have jumped in, I think he'd have just collapsed anyway.
Yeah.
But his muscle memory knew what he had to do, and he sort of jumped on him.
That's the thing as well. With stuff like that, like for example, like that, as a referee, you're looking how his body's reacting, and you also say, "Look, Kevin, show me you're good. Show me something. You know, I need to see that you're still in the game." You know, same with people who fighters go, you know, intelligently defending yourself. The one thing I say in my rules talk is just covering up, throwing one shot back, or shrimping once, or whatever it is you're doing. If you hear the referee saying, "Improve your position, show me you can get out of it," that means at that specific time, whatever you have been showing me, while whether it be their strikes on the ground or on top or standing up against the cage or the ropes, whatever you're showing me at that specific time is not deemed as intelligently defending yourself. I mean, I had one a couple of weeks ago on a show where the guy got full mount on top of a guy from the bottom, and the guy from the bottom was just throwing one punch and one buck. That's all he was doing. Look, and that was within 30 seconds of the fight starting. Okay? Now, I'm not going to let another 4 minutes, 30 seconds of you just doing that, taking shots, and you just throwing one shot and one buck from underneath. That isn't intelligently defending yourself, you know? And he was contesting it, jumping in my face, etc. Come on, ref. I was okay. Look, I'm not cut, etc. I would plainly said to him, look, this energy that you're jumping up and down in my face and telling me you was okay, you should have used it to try to get out of it or go and work a ground game, you know?
Yeah. Another prime example from a UK fighter, obviously Nathaniel Wood.
Yeah.
One of his fights in Cage Warriors, he was dropped, got back up, dropped the other guy, and they both stood there trading.
Yeah.
And they both took shots. And everyone's like, oh, well, that it was shit how he was taking a beating.
Yeah.
And then he turned it around and gave the other guy a beating. But the difference was when Nathaniel Wood was taking the beating, he was throwing shots back.
Yeah.
He was getting shots off of him. He wasn't taking as much damage because he was doing like a boxing shuffle, basically. Not all the shots were hitting him. So he was still moving. You could still hear the referee saying, stay active, defend properly.
And the thing is, in that specific fight, again, I can guarantee you 100% the referee, I believe it was either Mark or Richard, one of the two, I promise you they were looking at the eyes as well, and seeing how you could. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen someone get knocked out or the shutdown of them eyes, boom, shutting down straight away. As soon as you see that, we're in, so you don't have to take any unnecessary punishment. Take that third or fourth shot, that's gonna literally put you out cold. You know, we're there to prevent that. And I hear fighters say all the time, well, you should have let me get knocked out, you should have did. It's like, dude. If that's the case, if I let you get knocked out when I can clearly see I can step in and stop the fight, I'm not doing my job right.
Yeah.
You know, it's different if you get a boom, a flash knockout with a shot that, you know, no one saw coming, or it happens, you know, you get shut down quick. That's different. But if you're taking flurry of punches, or shot after shot, and three or four landing, I want to step in before that fifth and sixth one lands. That's going to shut you down, you know. And a referee will always cover their back by saying, show me something, improve your position, get out of there. I need to see more than what you're showing me. You know?
Like with your whole basis, what you were saying, like what's involved in to be a ref. Obviously, the fighters have it where if they win a fight in devastating fashion, they go up in the ranks. They want to go higher and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's the same from obviously like a referee's point of side. You're starting on these smaller shows. If you make a big balls up with a call,
yeah,
or you let someone take an absolute beating, you're not going to get booked for another show. And yeah, these other big shows aren't going to come in. So obviously, if your end goal is either like Bellator, BAM, or UFC, or what have you, even as a referee, you've still got career goals. This is what people sort of need to realize. Like, obviously, people like Mario Yamasaki has come under lots of scrutiny straight away from Dana White. But do you see other referees in there that you think, oh, that they made a bit more of mistakes, sort of thing? But they're still not. You're still going to get booked for shows if you do well. You make the right call, and obviously not so much explain yourself, but if, like you said, you had that fighter a couple of weeks ago, if he turns around and then goes back and watches it, and his coaches and stuff say, oh yeah, that was the right call, this, that, and the other, then you're going to explain yourself, what it was for.
I'm not going to name the fighter, but I had one on the last Bama show, and someone picked it up, and sometimes as a referee, you forget that you're mic'd up, or there's a mic above your head. And one of the fighters was getting ground and pounded. And look, we always look at a situation that you're in, and sometimes we also assess that. Look, is this person gonna get out of there out of his punishment, you know, or is it gonna be the same position and taking the same punishment for the duration of the round, you know? So obviously, I made the call to stop the fight, etc. And I said to him, I said, dude, you'll look back at this fight. And you'll know why I stopped it. Because like, you go there, why did you stop it? I said, you know why I stopped it. But you look back at it and you will realize why I stopped the fight. You know, and I like to think that he did go back and he did realize, hey, do you know what? All right. Okay. Especially the men, as egos, we never want to give up. You know, we'll take him as many beatings. Like I said, fighters turn around to me and say, let me get knocked out or choked out, you know. And that situation, again, if I hadn't stopped that fight and I'd let that guy take a beating and say he did lose and he got absolutely pummeled, who's the first person they're going to turn around and go, oh, it's his fault? Me, you know, or the referee to go, hey, he should have stopped it earlier or he should have stepped in there quicker, you know? So like I said, it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't sport or a job as a referee, you know? So it's a hard one.
Do you ever get stuck in it where, obviously, you might look at the build-up to the fight, the hype of the fight when you're on bigger shows or what have you? Do you ever... It must be really hard. Sorry. It must be really hard to not stand and watch and just enjoy the fight.
I'm
officiating.
Yeah, even if I answer the first question, I can put a second part to that. No, you know, when I'm in there and officiating the guys, no matter whether, like I said, whether it be a grassroots level, whether it be an undercard, or whether it be the main card or a bigger show, I see two fighters as fighter A and fighter B. You know, and that is simple as that. And my job is in there to protect their safety and make sure they come out of there in one piece if I can, and make sure the fight flows and plays out the way it's meant to be, you know. And not to get involved too much, but on the other hand, so no, I won't be standing there. Don't get me wrong. Back here, sometimes you go, oh man, this is such a good fight. It's go, you know, it's amazing that I'll get
that's
to
what I'm sort of getting
fight.
At. You think
that's fine, but as soon as I'm in there, to me, whoever they may be, honestly, in my head, the fight A, fighter B. I don't care if they've coming from a fight where they've had five knockouts, or guys coming back from a fight where it can take a shitloads of beating and then come back and fight, etc. Because that night or that day may not be the day. So if he's a referee, you go in there going, okay, look, I'll let this guy take a little bit extra beating because his last fight when this happened, he managed to throw a left hook or a head kick and knock the other guy out. If I think like that all the time, that night could be the wrong night to do that. Next thing you know, he's knocked out. Oh, shit, ref, why didn't you stop that fight? Oh, but because last time I thought, you know, he managed to... You know, weather the storm and throw something back and he managed to win. If you think like that, no. Every fight, I just see it as a fight, A and B. Even when I'm sitting at cage side, while the other officials are officiating, I still, yes, all right, you may watch it more as a relaxed from a different view, different angle. But for me, as a referee, I still need to be there watching that fight just in case a situation occurs where my fellow colleague or my fellow referee needs an answer or an advice. Hey, Dan, was it an eye poke? Hey, Dan, did it get kicked in the groin? Dan, did that horn get did was the horn or the bell rung when I stopped here? Did you see a tap? You know, whatever it may be, whatever help. So it's still, while I'm sitting around that cage with that ring, my, you know, my, I'm still in my role of being an official, you know. So,
so when it is like that, obviously, like you said, with an eye poke or something like that, you obviously you don't see it much. Where a referee will go over to the side of the cage and say, "Was it an eye poke?" Do you sit obviously cage side, and if they shout out to you, sort of thing, obviously because they'll know where you sit. You can say to them before the fight, "I'm sat here. If you're not sure of anything, shout it out to me." Is it just a nod, or
if they need to, they can ask. They can even ask the judges, especially like the groin shot, etc., or the eye poke. But like I said, I like to think that a referee when he sees the eye poke or a groin shot, he's the only guy who can stop the fight at that time, whether it be to call time or bring the doctor in. He or she are the only people who can do that. So you can't have a official from the outside or a judge going, ref, you got poked in the eye, or the corner man shouting at you. Listen, if the referee hasn't seen it, because you see, I've seen it a couple of times where fighters themselves call time. You know, they're like, time, you know. As a fighter, you cannot call time. Don't get me wrong. You can sometimes tell from a body language if it was a definite eye poke, or groin shot, you can tell. I think there was a fight a couple of weeks ago on the UFC that I watched where a guy tried to claim that he got poked in the eye. But previously to that, in that fight, he had been poked twice in the eye. But the third time, no way was it a poke. And you just saw Herb Dean saying, nah-uh. That wasn't a poke, my friend, and I didn't see it. If a referee doesn't see it, you cannot call time, you know? So I like to think that most referees do pick it up. And, like, if you ever need any advice or you need a second back in, just clarification, yeah, you can use your other officials to make that clarification. But the referee in the middle is the only guy or girl who can make that final decision and final call anyway on anything in there.
Good stuff. So you obviously... You fought as well.
Yeah.
And then you went into personal training and stuff, and now you're in officiating.
Yeah.
Does stuff like this sort of come hand in hand with it? Obviously, from, like you said, not all officials do some sort of training or something like that. Do you? And you said that they should.
Yeah.
Do you think, obviously, if fighters do retire, to stay in for the love of the game, obviously, like yourself, you do it for the love of the sport. Do you think the majority of them, obviously you can't have a whole roster retiring and then going into officiating, but do you think it sort of comes hand in hand to,
yeah, of course,
once you finish fighting, to go into something like coaching or even personal training, or like yourself into officiating?
I think so. Talking just specifically officiating side of stuff, I think it does help. Even judging, not just refereeing, but even judging, knowing what you're looking for, what the, you know, what the submission attempts are, like guard passing, the stuff they're going for, effective striking, etc. Seeing stuff like that as a fighter to be able to judge the fight or having some sort of combative background, I think does help. You know. And especially the coaching side of it, like you said, like Jack Mason and even Brad Pickett, they're the two guys that spring to mind. They've got good, solid fighters that, you know, the fighters can look up to them and go, hey, look, you know, these guys achieved things on a bigger platform. They got good knowledge. They've traveled the world. They've done this. They've done that. Of course, it does help, you know. Whereas if you got someone coming from, I don't know, used to stack shelves in Sainsbury's and wants to just come jump straight in and try to be a coach or try to be a referee straight away, they can, not saying they can't do it, but it's still a grind. You know, you still got to be willing to put them hours in to learn the moves, to learn what's what and what you know, what the rules are, etc. So, as far as it benefiting people, yes, of course it does. Not coming from the sport that you're trying to help or you love or you want to work for, coming from a background, some sort of background of it, of course it does help.
And anything sort of you can give back to the sport.
Of course.
Even at grassroots level, whether it be any of them, coaching, fitness or anything like that. It could be one of your friends who is a fitness freak and anything like that. All helps towards grassroots.
Of course it does. And that's the thing that people need to remember. You know, grassroots level is the key, whether it be just in fighting or coaching or refereeing. You know, you need to start, literally start from the bottom and work your way to the top. And that's the way it's got to be. And it's not going to come overnight. It's not going to come, you know, within a year, 2 years. So don't get me wrong, there's some outliers there who do make it within a couple of years. But majority of the time, you just got to put that grind and go put that work in. Whether you think, you know, look, I'm not going to make it, or it's hard work, you just got to push through it, you know.
Yeah, it's like I watched a countdown this morning. It was scheduled to be on last night for the UFC 224.
Yeah.
And Jacare Souza said after his last fight, he had an injury. And he was actually contemplating giving the sport up.
Yeah.
Not for the lack of love for the sport or anything like that, but just solely because of his injury.
Yeah.
And he actually stated that he had multiple offers because he spoke to a few guys that he trained with and stuff like that. The different gyms that he'd gone to, that they were like, straight away, we'll have you as a coach, because obviously he is a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu world champion. That experience that he's had, he could give to these younger guys and stuff like that. So having people, like you said, like Brad and Jack and stuff like that, that have had the experience and know what it is like at the top of the level in the sport that people want to get into, even if it's just the mentality that they're helping them with, or motivation or something like that.
Or putting two good events on, like Rise of Champion and BCMMA or Cage Warriors Academy, now it's known as Southeast. That's giving that platform for these young guys from their gyms, from other gyms around the local area to be able to participate in and get their names out there, is a hell of a big step. It's a great thing they're doing, you know? So I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, and like we were saying, like you said, some fighters might do it where they get straight back up and do it. One of the guys that I spoke to, Jordan Baxter, he actually got to the final of that 8-man tournament.
Yeah.
And he wants it so bad to get to this European Grand Prix. He's actually gone to a different academy now to go and fight for a title on June 2nd.
There we go. So the opportunity, you know, sometimes the opportunity is open, you know?
Yeah, it's some people just have the mentality of wanting it more than others, so to speak.
Yeah. No, I think, like I said, with the sport and the way it's going, you know, fighters should be grateful, the officials should be grateful, and the fans definitely should be grateful for what the fighters and they put themselves through for at the end of the day, for their entertainment. You know, that's what it's about. You know, for our entertainment as fans, the two guys or the two girls, you know, fighting it out and putting their bodies through the test of finding out who's got the better skills, etc. And it is for entertainment, you know. So I think a lot of people should be grateful and thankful for what they do. You know, like I said, it's without them, there wouldn't be no sport. You know.
Yeah, and for guys like yourself, there wouldn't be a sport either. This is what I think some fighters and fans don't realize. If they keep giving refs shit, whether it be on social media, some might have stronger mentality than others. Obviously, if you come under loads of scrutiny on social media, if 10,000 people tweet you saying, no, you got that wrong, you do this, you do that, you shit at this, you don't do this right, that's wrong, you're not doing this right, you could just be like, well, do you know what, sod it, I'm not
my man. But I try to take no notice of that, Scott. And sometimes I've turned around and said, hey, buddy, here's my gloves, you get in here and do it.
Yeah, see, that's what I mean. But some people might just say, do you know what? If they've had it for years and years, enough's enough. Like,
if everyone
did that, then we wouldn't have a sport. Because if we had no officials, it'd just be two guys fighting in the street.
Yeah, I know.
Because you wouldn't be able to hold these shows.
Well, you say that. Some shows do hold shows without any good officials, you know. But luckily, there are some out there who do work shows, you know, like... I can name many guys who are great officials, and again, they don't get the respect they need and they deserve, you know. But it's good to see that shows do sort out officials who are there to do a good job and do what they do best and trust that the decisions they make on that night, whether it's a promoter, it's your biggest ticket seller that you've pissed off or you've made the call against for whatever reason, that they trust your decision. Now, hey, look, whatever Dan or Mark or Leon say, that's the way it is, you know. That's what it's going to be, you know.
Good stuff. Right, I'm going to thank you for your time. I know you're a busy guy.
Thank you very much.
Get back to it and enjoy some rest after training.
Yes, I am. I'm just about to knock up some lunch and get.
If there's anyone you want to shout out or anything like that?
No, I just want to say thank you again for giving me the platform to have a good conversation. We sorry it wasn't really tied in with officiating kind of side of stuff, but it was actually nice talking about just in MMA in general and life, so to speak. And best of luck with your podcast, and I look forward to hearing from it, and hopefully see you at a show soon.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's what I said to my partner earlier. She was like, oh, have you finished your questions for him? I said, I've wrote a few down. I said, but I'm going to try.
Just go off.
I said, because, well, I've done a few, and some of the questions have just been answered, like, and that's it. And it's like, oh, I've planned for like 20 questions here, and they've lasted 25 minutes.
Man, it's more of a podcast than a chat rather than an interview. Of a bullet point question, so it's nice just how it flew.
I said to her, I'm just going to wing it and see how it flows. And
I'm hoping it's paid off, and I hope it comes out well for you.
Yeah, thank you again. So, right, I'm going to shout out CBD Life UK. They've jumped on board to support me with my podcast. If you go on the CBD Life website and you use promo code MONSTARS15, you get 15% off your first order. And Ultimate Fighting Outlet, if you go and check them out, great gear, everything you need from tape to wraps to shorts, t-shirts, gum shields, pads, the lot. If you use promo code MONSTARSMMA, you get 10% off your order. And again, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
No problem.
I hope to see you.
Yes.
To finally meet you at a show.
Definitely, Scott. Not a problem, my man.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Have a good day.
Cheers.
See you later.